So what there was something I wanted to talk about.
Is it that tonight is a full moon in Scorpio? Is that what you wanted to talk about?
No, I don't really care about that because that's not real. I mean, the full moon is real, but the other thing isn't real. That's just some shit people made up.
I mean, it might be real. You don't know.
It's superstitious nonsense, Jamie.
It's a little stitious.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe it's not that super. I repeatedly said 4x3 when we were talking about the aspect ratio of First Cow, and I was very upset with myself listening back to it, because 4x3 is a television aspect ratio. 1:33:1 or 1.33:1 is a cinema aspect ratio. They mean the same thing, but people who know that I was saying the wrong term last time, and I'm very embarrassed.
Wow, it really doesn't sound like that matters at all.
No, but it's just how we talk about things. It's how we talk about things, Jamie.
It's how you talk about things.
If I called an appellation, like, just an area, you would be like, there's political and regional and economic class strata that define what an appellation is. And if you just call it an area, you're leaving out all of that important cultural context to the French grape-picking societies.
Wow, that was an excellent impression of me.
It was spot on.
I think you've got a real future in stand-up comedy and impressions.
Or at least voice work. Jamie, you should introduce the show.
Let's introduce the show.
Let us begin.
Welcome to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome! Oh, I just peeked there.
I'm Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I'm Scott. I'm having trouble controlling the volume of my voice. I'm the movie guy.
Oh, man. And also our producer and the guy that should know how to control the volume of his voice.
Yeah, it's going to be my problem is the important thing.
Anyway, we're pairing wine with movies, hopefully exploring the synesthesia between the two in a way that doesn't make you want to bash your head on a wall.
Ooh, I actually had a thought about this. Because we're not exploring the synesthesia between the two of them. We are hoping to discover synesthesia between the two of them. It's not inherently there. Like, we're kind of mining for it. We're digging for it. We're searching for them gold bars.
Okay.
You know,
we're digging. I mean, we're exploring also applies, I think.
But we're also, like, inventing. We're fabricating. we're stretching ourselves to find synesthetic connections between two disparate mediums.
With all of the navel gazing that we do on this show, I don't think that we also need to, like, nitpick the tiny word choices in our intro, but, you know.
But then it'll be better. Anyway, proceed, James. Continue apace.
So this is an inversion of our format a little bit. I chose the wine first, gave Scotty Boy some descriptors, and he paired the movie.
That's right.
So I chose Stolpman Vineyards La Quadrilla Syrah Grenache Sangiovese Blend 2018 from Ballard Canyon, California. I gave Scott the descriptors elegant, meaty, broad, and for sure with a conscience on a number of different levels.
But so I chose, based on those adjectives, Spike Lee's 2020 film, Defy Bloods. This is continuing our 6-part unofficial miniseries on 2020, the year that wasn't. So Defy Bloods is about 4 black Vietnam War veterans who return to Vietnam in the present day to find the body of their lost beloved squad leader, Stormin Norman, played by the late Chadwick Boseman, and bring his body back home, along with a cache of lost American gold that was intended for the Vietnamese that the Bloods never got the chance to steal and bring back home as a form of reparations. The Bloods, the squad, are Paul, played by the unbelievably great Delroy Lindo, Otis, played by Clark Peters, Melvin, played by Isaiah Whitlock Jr., and Eddie, played by Norm Lewis. And Jonathan Majors plays Paul's son David, who talks his way into the mission. It's a war movie. It's a war movie about Vietnam War movies. It's kind of a heist movie. And it is a Spike Lee movie. So it's an explicit, very blunt polemic about the black experience in America then and very much about now.
Explicit and blunt really does sum up the style that we've become accustomed to from Mr. Lee.
Well, but we'll get into it, because yes, explicit, always blunt. It's that elegant thing that I struggle with on this movie, because some of his movies are elegant and this one is not at all.
I believe there to be some elegance here, honestly.
I think there's one one bit of elegance in the entire movie, and we'll discuss it when we talk about it.
We're gonna get to that. I'm interested to see what your bit of elegance is.
Indeed. But yes, Jamie, tell me about this wine, which I am now closing in on the end of my second bottle of, and I quite like it. I think it's very good.
Yeah, it's super duper yummy. So Stolpman Vineyards is a producer in Ballard Canyon. Ballard Canyon is a double nested AVA.
Oh, so boy. We've talked. All right. Yep.
I know we're already.
Let's hear it.
I'm already confusing Scott. I need to know
how something is nested, what it means to be double nested, and I need to know what the A, the V, and the A all are.
We've talked about AVAs before. You should remember.
That is absolutely not true.
So, AVA means American Viticultural Area. It's the U.S. equivalent of AOC in France or DOC in Italy. It is
AOC also in Brooklyn, I believe, right? Brooklyn?
The wrong AOC, homie.
Wrong AOC.
Although we do love her. She's great.
Big fan.
Huge fan of AOC. And every time I see her speak, I do think about my wine nerditude and how her name stands for Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez and also Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée. Anyway.
I thought you were going to say that it makes you think what a waste and a non-contribution to the country your wine nerdery is. Because every time I hear her speak, I'm like, oh, she's like 30 and I'm a guy who like tries to carve time out of his day to watch a movie once. Like, what the fuck am I doing with my life?
Yeah, she's an exceptional person and we're lazy fucks who talk at microphones. But anyway, circling back, AVA is the American appellation system. We've talked about appellations before, the place names, right? So Ballard Canyon is nested within the Santa Ynez Valley, which is itself within Santa Barbara AVA. Stolpman has been around since 1990, when Tom Stolpman and his wife established the estate. Most of the grapes went to other producers at that time because Tom was and still is a lawyer and not a winemaker. But ever since 2009, his son, Pete Stolpman, and Pete's wife, Jessica, have taken over management and redirected most of the production to their own lines of wines. This wine comes from Stolpman, Stolpman Vineyards. They have several lines of wines. The top end is their estate bottlings. Then you have the So Fresh, So Clean bottlings, which tend to be like whites, rosés, orange wines done all zero sulfur, very sort of natural. And then this line, which is called La Cuadrilla, which translates from Spanish as either the squad or the crew. There's a guy named Ruben Solorzano, who is the vineyard manager for, among other wineries, Stolpman Estates. Ruben employs his squad of vineyard workers year-round, which is sort of part of the philosophy between him and Stolpman. Many in California vineyards are seasonal, and they have to sort of be migratory and move around with the seasons in order to get agricultural work where they can get it. A few estates, like Stolpman, employ everyone year-round. One of the cool things that they do is this line of wines, which are set up to be profit share with the squad. It was originally born as Ruben just gave these guys a block to do with as they please, and they would make the farming decisions, and then the wine would get made, and it was for them and their families to enjoy. And then it sort of expanded and became commercially viable, and now it's a profit-sharing thing between the winery and the workers. And I think that is super-duper rad.
That's pretty awesome. How do they afford to pay the squad year-round? Like, do they come up with other work for them to do when there's not planting and harvesting and barreling to be done?
My guess would be that keeping people on year round increases their skill level and their familiarity with like your processes, your land, the way you do things, so that when it comes to the busy time, when you would maybe hire a bunch of seasonal laborers, you can get the job done with fewer.
Right. And then the people that you have don't end up being so specialized in what they know how to do. It's not just, I know how to do the stuff we do in summer. It's, I know the whole process now.
So I've talked a little bit about the producer. We love Stolpman. I think that they're just they kind of do it the way I like wine to be made. It's done with an eye for sustainability. It's not certified organic or biodynamic, but it's, you know, they use cover crops and no till, or like less till, and dry farming and all of the things that I like. And they treat their people great, which is awesome.
That is pretty cool.
This wine is a blend. It's 70% Syrah, 15% Grenache, and 15% Sangiovese.
Sangiovese!
Sangiovese.
Gonna do it every time.
And Sangiovese is a little bit of a weird outlier there, because like Syrah and Grenache are traditional blending partners. You see them together a lot in the Rhone Valley, in the United States, in Spain even. You know, Syrah and Grenache kind of go together. And sometimes they're blended with Cunoaz or Carignan or even more typically Mourvedre. But here it's with Sangiovese. And I think part of that is Stolpmann hangs their hat on Sangiovese and they probably have a little bit more than they need for their estate bottled varietal Sangiovese. But also, the limestone soils here in Ballard Canyon really react well to Sangiovese, and I would expect not as well to those other varieties that I mentioned. So that 15% Sangiovese, for me, like, I can feel that in this wine. It's like the extra tannic grip that's there. And you were saying the other night that you tasted copper in this wine. I think it's more sanguine, more like irony, almost blood. But they're like,
I'm not tasting a lot of irony, Jamie. I mean, I'm getting a little bit of sarcasm.
This is a very funny joke.
A little bit of.
Come on, you can do it.
Nope. Vocabulary's dried up. I got nothing else.
Oh my God. He's forgotten words, folks. He has
so many words. I've forgotten all the words. All the words.
I shouldn't make fun of you. I also have forgotten all of the words.
Goddamn right you have. But so you think it tastes more iron-ish than copper-y?
Yes, than copper-ish. But like that's splitting hairs. You know, we're talking about a metallic aroma and flavor. Yeah. And I think that that's definitely there. But that kind of thing is typical of Sangiovese.
Maybe it's just the name, because the name and my predilection for making like broad, outlandish, borderline offensive Italian accents. When I hear Sangiovese, I think fun and light and bubbly and joyful. And you're telling me that the Sangiovese is where all that the tannin and tongue scraping and astringency is coming from.
Yeah, Sangiovese is not. I would not describe it in using any of the words that you just used.
Hmm.
I mean, it can be fun, but it is serious.
You were saying that Syrah and Grenache are frequent kissing cousins, right? They're often blended together.
That's correct.
Why?
That's a complicated question that I think a winemaker would be better to answer than me.
Well, I don't have one of those in front of me right now, so you tell me. What is it about Syrah that when you have 70% Syrah, they're like, well, you know what, 15% Grenache, that's going to be pretty good in there.
The grapes themselves are very divergent, and I think that's one of the things that makes them work so well together. Syrah is a very thick-skinned variety. It usually produces small berries. It's very intensely flavored. It's capable of sort of like cool climate, lower alcohol, high acidity wines.
Okay.
And it's very, very savory in character. Whereas Grenache is thin-skinned, doesn't add a lot of color, is lower in acidity, lower in tannin, but much, much higher in sugar potential, so you're going to get higher alcohol out of it, and much more fruit-driven in its character. So to strike a balance between the two, it is smart to blend them. The Southern Rhone Valley, areas like Châteauneuf-du-Pape or the Côte du Rhône.
Oh, come on, Jamie, you can do better. Put a little French spin on that. Come on.
Nope.
Châteauneuf-du-Pape.
Or Gigondas or Vacheron. They tend to be Grenache-dominant blends, but to add color and structure, they bring Syrah into the mix.
That was an astute and I think to the point answer. That was great. I didn't need a winemaker. You were thoroughly up to the task.
I'm going to guess that there are plenty of winemakers out there who would either disagree with me or like add several parentheticals to that, but we'll...
Well, they'd have to be listening first.
That's true. And we've got a handful of winemakers listening.
That is pretty cool.
So to all of y'all, you know, if you've got corrections for me, go ahead and slide in them DMs.
Yeah.
And I will make a public mea culpa with your words.
We will address them on the air. Can I tell you what I think it tastes like?
Yeah.
You mentioned one of my notes, but I got my notes here. Here's what I was getting. Once again, I kept thinking about blood while drinking this wine. But this time it was like explicitly a flavor thing. When I was watching it with First Blood, I couldn't point to anything in First Blood. That's a totally different movie. Sort of name checked in To Five Bloods. No, when I was watching First Cow with the Prodica, I couldn't actually point to anything in there that made me think of blood. I just kept thinking of it. But in this one, that copper to me came out of thinking, it tastes like blood. Like I got punched in the mouth and, you know, my gums are bleeding.
Right. You know that it's actually iron that's in your blood and not copper, right?
But blood, like if you were to describe the taste of blood, like it's
yeah,
it's
people
a fistful
say that
of
it tastes like pennies.
It tastes like pennies. Well, this wine has a savory note to it. And when I put that in my little notes app the other day, I had forgotten that you said it was meaty. So I came to that somewhat all on my own through, absence of memory. But I was also getting strawberry. I was getting plum, some kind of sweet reddish fruit that I couldn't quite put my finger on. But I had plums in the room, so I thought maybe it was plums. I was getting that black pepper. I was getting black coffee.
Black coffee. It's a good one.
And lemon. Little bit of lemon.
Yeah, totally.
Those were my notes. I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Of the wines that I chose for this, call it season.
I will not.
This wine was the one that I was most certain you would enjoy. It's fruit forward. It is medium plus in body, medium plus acidity. I think my big flavor notes for this wine are ripe blackberry and currant, ripe red cherry and raspberry, violets, blood, rendered pork fat, and because I have my head all the way in my ass, telecherry peppercorn.
Well, I'm gonna ignore that one because that was clearly bait for me to ask you a question. Violets? Violets like the little purple flowers? Violets?
Like the little purple flowers, yeah.
What do those taste like in this? What in this wine makes you think about eating little purple flowers?
About smelling little purple flowers, Scott.
Man, I can't tell because sometimes it's stuff that you're eating and sometimes it's stuff that you're smelling. I don't know which is the thing. Sometimes
how many times do we have to go through this?
Obviously, you're eating
flavor
leather
and aroma.
And sometimes you're smelling
the same
manure.
Thing. It's the same sense, Scotty.
Then why does palate have to confirm nose, Jamie? If
because the
says
difference
it,
is that you perceive them in different ways. We've talked about this. You smell the wine without tasting it. That's going one way. Then you taste it and some of the volatile aromatic molecules will be perceived by your, what's the word?
Schnuffer.
Not schnuffer. Olfactory bulb.
That's two words.
Retronasally. Which is a totally different way to perceive the wine, and it gives you a different lens to look at it through. If that helps your visual mind.
Okay, fine. Thank you for giving me like a visual metaphor that I could work with. What in this wine are you smelling?
Makes
you think of smelling low purple flowers.
I'm smelling flowers. It smells like flowers.
But it smells specifically like violets.
Specifically like violets, yeah.
What do violets smell like?
At the risk of being entirely recursive, they smell like fucking violets, Scott.
This is not helpful at all, Jamie. I'm really worried about your chances with the exam later this summer. If this is how you're going to answer direct questions about what things smell like.
I'm very worried about my chances on this exam, by the way.
So am I too now.
That has nothing to do with trying to express what the smell of violets is. You have to go and smell violets.
Jamie.
Yes.
Jamie, it's an audio medium. Work with me here. Help out the listener. What do violets smell like? If you had to describe them, which for the purposes of this enterprise you do, what do they smell like?
Violets smell like flowers.
God damn it. I'm going to Google. We're just doing it. Google, the algorithm's going to have to tell us. I typed the word Google. Good Lord.
What do violets smell like? I'm interested.
So according to theperfumesociety.org, violet flowers smell soft. F*** you. They can't smell soft. Anyway,
yes, they can.
Violet flowers smell soft, powdery and romantic, a little like iris, and can be played up to create a very feminine fragrance.
Yeah, see, that wasn't helpful, right?
Green, that was not helpful at all.
This is what I've been trying to tell you. Like, there are certain things that are really difficult to break down because they're already a very base.
Like, you can't reduce it any further.
Yeah.
It's the base element. All right, I guess I have to go to my garden center again this week and get violets and start sniffing them, but not buy any.
That's correct. Yeah, I would absolutely do that. The violets are violets. That's all I got for you, man.
Wow.
I know you're mad about it, but like, you didn't ask me what telecherry peppercorn smells like.
No, because you clearly wanted me to ask you about that.
Dick.
But it's a peppercorn, right? It's a peppercorn.
Yeah, it's a specific species of black peppercorn that is native to India that I worked with a bunch at Tashan when I worked there, the fine dining Indian restaurant that I bartended at. And it's sort of like indelible in my mind. Imagine black pepper, but simultaneously there's an earthier base note and a like almost lemony top note.
See, these are things I can work with. These are good. You're very good at describing things when you want to and you're not just digging your heels in, Jamie. I can now imagine that smell.
Violets smell like violets, Scott. I think that's just about all I wanted to say wine before we get to the pairing.
Well, then let's play that game, baby. Let's play that game.
Yeah, let's play that game.
We got to do it. We're going to Wine Folly.
So what are we doing? Are we doing Syrah or are we doing...
I have decided, yes. This week we would do Syrah.
Okay.
So it'll be Jamie versus the 5 primary flavor notes on winefolly.com on their page for Syrah, which is the... Do we call it the primary grape in this, the principal grape?
The primary, I would say.
The primary? Is there like a specific nomenclature? Are the other two like secondary grapes or?
It depends on who you ask and on like how the blend is put together.
All right. Well, so to remind everyone how the game is played and to remind you, Jamie, how the game is played.
Yeah, remind me. I don't remember this game because.
You don't. You don't remember week to week. Jamie is going to try and guess what WineFolly.com's 5 primary flavors are for the grape Syrah, and then we will then reveal how successful he was.
That's not true. What I'm actually going to do is say what I think the 5 primary flavor notes are for Syrah, and we will compare them with WineFolly.
What if you just tried? What if you just tried to play the game? Just for once, what if you indulged me? That might be an interesting challenge for you. That might help you along towards your master's exam. Put yourself in the mind of Madeleine Pouquet.
I kind of live for the moments where I say a thing and you just can't with the whole world because I've said a thing that makes you upset. I live for those moments, Scotty boy.
Boring. All right, Jamie, what do you think the 5 primary flavor notes of Syrah are? Drum roll, please.
Oh, Scotty's mad now.
I'm not even doing a theme song. This game is just not fun anymore because Jamie just, there's not even a chance he's ever going to play. I come up with this game for you, for our show. It's centered around you, gives you a chance to sound smart. You don't make up a game for me. I don't get a trivia game from you. I don't get anything like that. And you can't even meet me on my own terms and play the game the way the rules are written.
I'm loving this saltiness. This is really, I you're feeding me right now. I feel warm.
This is episode
and
this
happy.
Is episode 8. So it's 16 weeks of resentment that is just boiling up here, pal.
This is episode 9, Scotty.
Fuck. Proceed.
Yes, Syrah flavor notes. I'm gonna go with black cherry, black currant. We'll say red cherry, black peppercorn. And smoked meat.
And smoked meat.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, drum roll or something, I guess. So to repeat, Jamie said black cherry, black currant, red cherry, black peppercorn, and smoked meat. WineFolly.com for Syrah. Primary flavors. Blueberry. Black plum.
Black plum.
Milk chocolate.
Hmm.
Tobacco. And green peppercorn.
Huh.
So, James, I'm going to give you half a point for saying peppercorn at all. And that's being generous, frankly.
That is being very generous.
And this is by far your worst performance.
I gotta say, I fully disagree with the tobacco call on there.
In Syrah in general? Not, yes. We're not talking about this wine. We're just talking about 70%
as a primary flavor driver in a grape broadly. Like, I can get with the different array of fruits because Syrah is capable of a lot of different things in a lot of different places. But tobacco? I don't think so. And you gotta talk about the animal quality that is in Syrah, that, like, pork fat or smoked meat, blood, like that kind of thing. I reject the idea that tobacco is in the top five.
Well, you know, I got nothing to say here, Jamie. It seems like you're getting your just desserts. And your desserts do not include black cherry, black currant, red cherry, black peppercorn, or smoked meat.
I could go for dessert.
I could go for some smoked meats. I want some brisket.
All right, and it would be really good with this wine.
Brisket would be really good with this wine. You didn't say, where is the wine available?
Yes. Moore Brothers Wine Company. Moore Brothers Wine Company has locations in New York, in Delaware, and in New Jersey. They don't ship to Pennsylvania, but it's right over the bridge, 15 minutes from my South Philadelphia home. And this La Quadrilla is $22.
That's pretty reasonable. And for anybody who is not Jamie-centric in when they gauge distances to places.
You can also, it's a domestic winery. You can order directly from the winery.
Ah, there you go. I would order directly from them. I really like this.
Da Five Bloods.
So it's on Netflix. It is what they call a Netflix original movie. It is from director Spike Lee. I will not do his entire filmography because it is quite lengthy.
It's extensive.
He has been very prolific in his many years as a filmmaker, starting in the mid-80s.
It was the mid-80s? Why did I think it was early 90s? I'm not trying to correct you. I'm just curious.
No, because you would be wrong. Like, his first masterpiece is 88, I think, 88 or 89, which is cool. When Do the Right Thing came out. The first of probably a couple of unqualified masterpieces that the man's made. So, yeah. It's Spike Lee's latest. It's the first movie he made since winning his very long overdue Oscar for Best Original Screenplay for Black Klansman.
Was that his first ever Oscar?
It was his first one ever. Do yourself a favor when we're done this recording. Audience, do yourselves a favor when you're done listening, or just pause or whatever, and go to the YouTube and look up Spike Lee Oscar acceptance speech. And that man's happy fucking dance, like scooting across the stage. He is the most joyful old man. It's just great. He was so giddy to win after having been snubbed and passed over time and time and time and time again.
I'm assuming that he had been nominated several times prior to that.
A couple of times, not as many times as you would think.
Ain't that some shit?
Yeah. Meanwhile, Do the Right Thing. We talked about this before when we talked about The Parasite, about the gulf between the Oscars and like the international like film scene. Do the Right Thing, I believe, won the Palme d'Or at Cannes for like a quintessentially American movie about an extremely American problem.
Recognized by the French, of course.
Right. Hang on, let me just check. I want to make sure it.
Hold on. I've got a knock at the door that I think is a package that I need to sign for. I'll be right back.
All right. Acceptable. While Jamie's going to check for the package, I should... Ooh, that's poor phrasing. While Jamie is going to see who's knocking at his door, I should correct myself. Spike was nominated for the Palme d'Or for Do the Right Thing. He did not win. That year, the winner was Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape. That's a pretty legitimate win, but yeah. You know, what one of those movies is Do the Right Thing, and the other one is not.
Sorry about that.
You're fine. Prior to winning for writing for Black Klansman, not directing, but writing, he was nominated for original screenplay for Do the Right Thing, did not win, and he was nominated for Best Documentary Feature for Four Little Girls and nothing else, which means
Jesus
that Malcolm
Christ.
X, it's insane. It's the Oscars. They're terrible. Let's not talk about them anymore. This project, Lee had to shop it to every studio and they all turned him down. So like he ended up going to Netflix and there was nowhere else to go after that because Netflix is, for all of its faults, kind of the only place that is giving big auteurist filmmakers in this country basically blank checks. Nobody else was going to give Scorsese $150 million to make a three-hour old people's digitally de-aged gangster movie.
Right.
Nobody else was going to give Spike Lee... I don't know what the number is on this movie. I would assume it's probably in the ballpark of $70 or $80 million. Nobody else was going to give him a budget to make a big, angry, you know, Spike Lee movie about the Vietnam War with black vets in their 60s.
But it's so good.
The movie started as a spec script. Do you know what a spec script is? Is that a phrase that you've heard?
It's a phrase that I've heard that I can weasel my way through a conversation that it's in without asking, but you should probably explain it to the people out there.
It's a script that somebody writes without anyone asking them to write it. Like it's not, you're hired by a producer and they say, adapt this novel, or you're hired by a producer and like, here's a script, rewrite it. Like it's your idea. It's an original idea for a screenplay that then you go out and try and sell.
Got it.
So it starts as a spec script by these two guys, Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo. It was called The Last Tour, and it was about four aging white veterans.
I was about to say, Danny Bilson and Paul DeMeo do not sound like black people.
No, they do not. But it was about four aging white vets who were headed back to Vietnam. Oliver Stone was attached to direct for a while. But the script comes to Spike Lee, who loved all of the echoes of Treasure of the Sierra Madre that are in it.
Wait, which is what? What is that?
Classic 1940s movie directed by John Huston, and it's Humphrey Bogart is part of a team of three desperate American expats living in Mexico who go fuck off into the mountains looking for gold. And their search to gold leads to, you know, the gold driving one of them crazy and betraying the others.
Yeah, that scans for this movie.
So Spike and his Black Klansman and Chirac co-writer Kevin Wilmot came in and they rewrote it. Spike's quote to Hollywood Reporter is, "We flipped it. We put our flavor on it, some barbecue sauce, some funk, some Marvin Gaye." And there you have it.
Marvin Gaye plays a major role in the soundtrack.
Huge
the
role.
Movie would not be the same without him.
It would be radically different.
Yeah.
Yeah, the soundtrack is all tracks from Marvin Gaye's, what is it? Is it 68 or 1970 album What's Going On, which is like explicitly a protest album that's against the Vietnam War. And it's like music that is significant to the context of what he's talking about. He opens the movie with that amazing and very brutal montage of just like catching you up on here's what was going on at home and here's what's going on in Vietnam while the war is going on, all set to inner city blues.
That was a very easy montage to watch. I didn't have any emotions during it at all.
Yeah. I'm a little conflicted, like, because he did the same thing with Black Klansman, where Spike does this. Like, he wants his movies to be rooted in the real world and in today and in the American problems of today. So he'll use real footage of real things that, like, relate to what's going on in his fictional or not-so-fictional stories. Like, Malcolm X opens with the Rodney King beating. Like, that's how that movie starts.
Right.
Black Klansman ends with footage of the Charlottesville riot, and then with the guy like driving the car into the crowd.
Oy vey.
And then this movie has I forget the man's name, but the Vietnamese guy who was executed on like television.
Yeah. Do you think that rooting or the using of montages or the real world context, do you not like that? Or do you
great. I just think sometimes like when you're an audience and you go in to watch a movie, especially a movie with genre trappings like this one, like I signed up to watch a war movie. I didn't sign up to watch actual violence. Like I didn't turn on Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's The Vietnam War 17-hour documentary. Like that's not the contract that I signed when I turned this movie on, you know? I have conflicted feelings about it.
Doesn't he kind of break those contracts regularly? Like
he does.
His whole thing, like every movie that I've seen of his has at one moment or another made me uncomfortable. And I think that's his goal.
I'm not saying it isn't fair game, but like I remember reading a bunch of or a handful of critics on Twitter last year who were really put off by some of that inclusion of like actual real world violence and just felt like it was a little bit too much. It's something I've been thinking about. I was really quite struck by it last night. Netflix picked it up. They're the only ones who want to pay for it. They guaranteed him a theatrical release, except COVID.
Except COVID.
So the movie premiered on Netflix in like late June of 2020.
Nothing was going on in June 2020, right? Nothing that is like relevant here?
No, that we shouldn't even be sarcastic about this. It's not that it's a timely movie. It's that this is always a timely movie, right?
Like
the
whole 100% of the time, it's a timely movie.
Yeah, that's the whole idea of the movie. The war never ends.
Just so happened that in June of 2020, it was fever pitch.
Yeah, it was the movie of the moment. So there are a lot of prisms or lenses through which you could look at this movie.
Yes.
And a very big and obvious and important one being the depiction and discussion of race and racism in America and in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie and I, you can probably tell from our voices, are stupid white men, and we are not the people to have that conversation. But there's plenty of smart people who did a lot of really good writing about Defy Bloods last year. And I just wanted to call out a couple of things if people wanted to like dig a little bit deeper on those themes that are so important and so front and center in the movie. And we can put links to these in the description, and we can share it all on social as well. So two terrific reviews that I really liked from last year from Black Critics. One is from Soraya Nadia McDonald, who wrote for The Undefeated. She wrote a terrific review of the movie that people should check out. She was also on Pop Culture Happy Hour's panel discussion about the movie, which is a really good conversation. Odie Henderson, who writes for RogerEbert.com, wrote a terrific review that I have a couple of quotes from that I may end up quoting before this episode is over. And then another, as sort of a counterpoint to the film, novelist and author Viet Thanh Nguyen wrote a piece for the New York Times that was expanding upon a viral Twitter thread that he did, like while he was watching the movie. He live tweeted the movie, which he looked at it from the perspective of, okay, so the movie does a really good job of representing the Black experience of the war, but how does it treat the Vietnamese experience? And
right.
He found it extremely lacking. It was a great Twitter thread. It's an even better New York Times editorial. It's called Vietnamese Lives, American Imperialist Views.
We're at the point in the pod where we want to talk about our takes and what we think of the movie. And
yeah,
I love it. Almost unqualified love it. You know, you talked about how Spike is so willing to get into it. That tone, his particular brand of like, fuck you, I'm saying what I'm saying, obviously kind of connects with how I like to live my life and how I like to present myself.
Yeah. Fuck you. I won't do what you tell me. The Jamie Rubin story.
That's another one in the just Rolodex of possible chapter titles for my memoirs. But like,
oh, I was going to say sex tape, but yeah.
Also, yes. And on top of all of that, you have this these incredibly compelling and relatable characters. They're relatable to me, even though I am a millennial white guy. And these are Vietnam veteran Black men. You know, there's nothing about our experience that's the same. And even one of them is a Trump supporter. I can still relate to the feelings that he's expressing. And I think that is an incredible triumph of writing, but then also, and we said it before, fucking Delroy Lindo's performance. Jesus Christ.
It was the performance of the year for me last year. Just a knockout performance.
Yeah, so my take on this movie is like, I just fucking love it. It's the kind, like, it's difficult. It's the kind of thing that I wouldn't blame anyone for being standoffish. But for me, it hits the tone where it is able to talk about something very important and very dour at times while still capturing my attention for the entirety of a 2.5 hour feature.
This is the third time that he's taken like a very tried and true genre and like put his own spin on it and used it as a vessel to smuggle, unsubtly, but like to smuggle all of his Spike Lee themes and ideas into a movie. Like with Inside Man in 2006, which is the more subtle version of it. It's a bank robbery movie that's actually also about 9/11 and about the militarization of the police post 9/11, and also about how if you're rich enough, we'll let you get away with atrocities and murdering our own citizens.
Right. Much more subtle, though, than this.
Much more subtle. And then, like, Black Klansman, which is, like, it's an undercover cop movie that just, you know, happens to be about exposing the Klan. The thing that I liked so much about this movie is how it is an example and a counterpoint to its own genre. Like, it's not that it's just a Vietnam War movie. It is a movie about Vietnam War movies.
Right.
Odie Henderson, in his RogerEbert.com review, mentioned this famous adage from Jean-Luc Godard, which is that in order to criticize a movie, you have to make another movie.
Is he saying you have to make, like, in order to criticize a movie, you have to be a filmmaker, or you have to, like, conceptualize a different movie?
You have to be a filmmaker, is basically what he's saying. That the only way to comment on a film is with another film.
Well, that's, I don't think, right, but I see where he's coming from.
No, I mean, he also, like, what was a film critic himself. But yeah, so this movie is loaded with references to, like, some of the great Vietnam War films, using that imagery to evoke the, like, mythologized version of Vietnam that Hollywood has depicted for so long.
Yeah, there's a big one that I think everyone gets, even if you haven't seen the movie.
Well, you mean the two big Apocalypse Now references, right?
Yes.
There's two
gigantic ones. In particular, the Ride of the Valkyries one.
Right. He uses Ride of the Valkyries as the Bloods begin their boat ride up the river. Like, in Apocalypse, it's played very famously when Robert Duvall's Air Cavalry helicopter unit attacks an entire village that they think is filled with Viet Cong, basically just because he wants to surf on this beach.
Right.
In that movie, it's the Wagner pieces scoring a scene of soldiers making war as this excuse for, like, recreation. And in Five Bloods, it's scoring them on, like, the boat with their cameras rolling and, like, in their, you know, casual vacation gear. And they're thinking that they're having recreation, but they don't even know that they're on their way to go and make war, because the war is not over for them. It's not over for that country, and it's not over for them either. And then, obviously, we have, like, the huge Apocalypse Now reference when the Bloods get together in the club in Ho Chi Minh City in the mm-hmm. beginning. And there was an actual club, apparently, in Ho Chi Minh City called Apocalypse Now. I believe it's no longer there, and they had to recreate this on a soundstage. You probably noticed there's aspect ratio changes throughout the movie. It's not subtle.
And they're showy about them. Yeah.
They're very showy. Some of them are... I prefer my aspect ratio changes to be a little more... I like cuts. I like a hard cut to an aspect ratio change with only, like, an occasional opening or widening of the frame. These are real flashy. These will have, like, there's one bit where, like, you're with the Bloods and it's in that 1:3:3 boxy aspect ratio that's all the flashbacks. And then a motorcycle cuts across the screen, and in him cutting across the screen, he brings with it not only the return to the modern day in Ho Chi Minh City, but also, like, the much narrower and wider 2:3:9 aspect ratio. Real flashy. He's having fun.
I think it looks great. I actually like the use of the flashy transitions. It's highlighting tone changes, but also time changes. I think it's really effective. Can you give our listeners just a primer on, you're saying 1:3:3 and 2:3:9?
I'm saying numbers. Yeah.
Little primer.
We'll have another link that we can share with people. We can put it in the description. So scroll down in your podcatcher feed, and it's in the description right there. Slate ran a piece interviewing director of photography, Newton Thomas Siegel, talking about all of the different aspect ratios for the movie. And it will have what a podcast cannot provide, which is visual references.
Cool. Everyone listening should note that Scott is gesticulating widely with his arms as he's explaining this.
I'm specifically doing it to my own Zoom frame to help Jamie out so he can see. So it's 239, 185, 178, 1:3:3.
Okay.
You got it?
I understand. I get it.
No one else does.
No one else does. Yeah. This is once again an auditory medium. You're falling into the same mistake that I did earlier.
Right, where you're refusing to describe a smell.
I wasn't... Listen, violets smell like violets, motherfucker.
But yeah, my take, it's great. You say you love it unqualified. You have unqualified love for it.
I do, yes.
I have some qualifiers. It's messy, and it's lumpy, and there's some stuff that really doesn't work.
Okay, I need you to... Because you always grind me up about the way that I describe wines. How the fuck can a movie be lumpy?
Think about the flow of this movie and the structure of this movie. It has some starts and stops, and it interrupts itself because it has, this is something Tolkien said about his own writing when he was writing The Lord of the Rings. The only reason it got to be that long is because he had incurred too many narrative debts. And this movie has, like, too many plot lines. Like, why is Paul's big soliloquy interrupted 3 or 4 times. And it's because there's too much other shit going on. And, like, that should be an unbroken, like, 7-minute thing. And instead, we cut away a few times. I think it saps it of some of its tension. I have a feeling it was shot and intended to be unbroken. But then for the overall structural needs of the movie, they break it up by cutting back to the other guys and finding out where the completely ill-defined Vietnamese gangsters, like, this is another problem with the movie, like, the criminal guys who are just something, like, Paul describes them as the Viet Cong and his paranoia, and as far as the movie's concerned, he's not wrong. Like, they might as well just be the Viet Cong still.
Right.
Like, they're so ill-defined. There's a lot of that. I think it's lumpy. It has things that feel kind of glomped onto it, you know, that don't work.
Glomped, a definite word in the English language.
G-L-O-M-P, glomp, to attach something adhesively but crudely, glomped.
Oh my God, I love that. Yes, I agree with you on all of its flaws. I just don't care is my whole take on this movie, because I love every good part about it so much. That's my thing.
We've talked about this before. I will take an ambitious misfire, and I'm not saying that this movie is a misfire, but, like, I think it's a byproduct of it being a script that existed and had a pretty tight structure and a pretty tight story, and then Spike and Kevin Wilmot came in.
And they glomped things onto it.
They made it a Spike and Kevin Wilmot movie, and that is the stuff that I really love, and then the other things kind of feel like vestiges of a more conventional action war movie.
That makes total sense. What we're really failing, though?
Yeah, this is long. I had a feeling this was going to happen.
Yeah, we have not touched the pairing yet.
Do you think it is successful?
I do.
Interesting. I do not.
I have qualifiers, but okay. I think it works, and I think it works remarkably well.
Fascinating. I think it doesn't work. Not that it doesn't work at all, but in our previous two, like, proper episodes about Parasite and First Cow, we both had, like, tangible pairing moments, right? Like, where we each had a moment where, like, the watching the movie with the wine made a connection, right?
Yeah.
Like, it sparked a third thing happening. And I didn't have anything remotely like that while I was watching this movie with the wine last night.
I will agree with you there.
I was just drinking the wine and I had no connective tissue at all. And I was like, oh, this is a good wine. This is a good movie. And I'm enjoying them both separately. But why do you think it is successful?
Partly because of, like, what you just said.
The glomping?
No. One of the, like, SOM cheat codes that you'll find is, like, you have a really superlatively good dish, but it's difficult to pair. So maybe you just choose a really good wine and the people at the table will, like, enjoy themselves. And it's not about anything specific between the two, but they don't clash against one another. They just don't necessarily click their gears together. So it works. I'm with you. I didn't get any kind of, like, synesthetic moment with this movie. The very most I could say is when this movie is at its most gritty and ham-fisted, like when it's
you mean like when it's like a big action movie and they're fighting and shooting machine guns and shit.
Exactly. Particularly the stuff when we're flashing back to their time in Vietnam, and you've got the, like, this young man playing Storm and Norman, and they've made the choice to go with the old man versions of these characters, which I think is a great choice.
Awesome.
It's super awesome, but it's also a big choice. It's not what I would call elegant, as I called the wine. And I think those moments work well because of the opposites pairing.
Oh, interesting.
Because something big and ham-fisted and gritty does go with something that is light on its feet and elegant and refined.
See, I think that actually is an elegant choice. What we're describing is that in all the flashbacks, when there was Storm and Norman, Storm and Norman is played by Chadwick Boseman, who is young and beautiful, and the other Bloods are all played by the same actors in their 60s from the present day stuff. And there's no makeup, there's no prosthetic, there's no younger actor doubles, and there's no Irishman style digitally de-aging. And Spike said a lot of that was just necessity. Like, we were shooting in the fucking jungle, prosthetics would have melted off, we didn't want to go with younger actors because you would have lost the emotional connection to the characters, and that Irishman technology is too fucking expensive. Like, Netflix was not going to give us another $100 million to do that. But by doing it the way that they do it, like, it suggests something else. It's telling you that it's memory. It's telling you that it's them as old men thinking back. And I think that has elegance to it. I think that is one of the few elegant choices in the whole movie.
That's funny. I think that choosing to do that maybe is elegant, but the way that it's like it is front and center. It is glaring. It is big.
Yeah.
It's loud. Like, it's all of these things that I wouldn't ascribe to an elegant way of doing things.
But I think it does so many things, like, comparatively effortlessly. You know, like, if they went the digitally de-aging route, or if they cast younger actors to play those characters, that would not be elegant. That is the conventional way of doing things, and it's what audiences would expect.
Yeah.
But it actually...
And it would take extra time to introduce those younger actors as their counterparts.
Right.
Which would be clunky and not elegant. You're right.
Right. And when I think of elegance, like, it's not just about, not wealth, but, like, it's richness, but it's also simplicity, right? Like, you achieve the most beautiful impact with the least amount of effort.
Yeah.
Like, elegance goes hand in hand with effortless.
It's a good argument, and I can get down.
This is effortless. They didn't have to do any extra work. They just put them in different costumes.
Right, but the effect is so huge, which is why it came off to me as not elegant. I'll grant you that it's elegant, but I think that maybe a qualifier is worth saying. And I've said this about wines before, but maybe this elegance is not exactly a ballerina doing the Nutcracker suite, but it's the linebacker for the NFL who has to learn ballet in order to play. Like, they give these guys ballet classes to give them nimbleness and lightness on their feet. So it's like, it's a blunt instrument with elegance.
I think if I were to add my own totally different qualifier, it's that I think the choice is elegant, but maybe the effect is not elegant.
That's fair to say too.
I think the choice is beautiful and so simple and is so evocative, but the effect is, yeah, it's jarring, especially like in the battle scenes when you have to see them run. So there's one other thing about it that I think is elegant,
okay.
and it's the Paul soliloquy.
Yes.
Which I also think is, like, it is beauty and power that is achieved in the simplest way possible, which is just, like, and I'm sure it's written that way, because there's a lot of direct address in Spike Lee's movies, sometimes in monologues, sometimes in things that feel like elevated soliloquies. That I find elegant. It is just so simple and so perfectly achieved, and it relies on great writing and very simple filmmaking. And just, it knows, like, he just knew. He was like, well, Delroy can do it. Delroy is going to take this, and he's going to knock it into the fucking stratosphere, and it's going to be the only thing that people are going to want to talk about from this movie.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
But the rest of the movie is glompy. The rest of the movie is glompy and not elegant. You can see the seams everywhere. You can feel the herky-jerky starts and stops, and it's blunt.
Back to the pairing.
Yeah.
The blood note in particular of this wine...
Yeah.
I think really...
It's meaty.
It's meaty.
It has a conscience.
Yeah.
What was the other one?
Broad.
And it's very broad. Like, it's very accessible.
Yes.
It's a war movie. It should have played on 3,000 screens nationwide and should have made a ton of money and be seen by a ton of people.
And yet, 2020. Thank you very much.
2020, baby!
I do want to say, the big thing for me that doesn't pair with this wine is Delroy Lindo. I think the character doesn't work with the wine. And there's sort of a roundabout way that I'm going to get to this. This movie deals with two separate zeitgeists. It deals with the zeitgeist of the 60s and the early 70s of the Vietnam era, and then present day. Delroy's character is firmly planted in the late 60s and the early 70s. It's almost explicit that he hasn't grown since then.
He's just, like, calcified.
Exactly. And that's why he identifies with the MAGA movement. That's why he wears that hat. He's just stuck in the rage of his youth. And his other bloods have moved on, either by dying or by starting families or by living their own lives. And this wine, there's a conversation about the zeitgeist of California viticulture. The early 80s, when the Rhone Rangers became famous, which is, yes, I'm going to talk about it.
Okay. All right. Okay.
The Roan Rangers were a group of young winemakers in California who were championing Roan varietals. So Syrah, Grenache, Mourvèdre, Roussanne, Marsanne, Viognier, in a landscape that very much deified Bordeaux varieties. Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon, etc.
Can I just ask?
Yes.
Did they name themselves the Roan Rangers, or did someone else give them that really terrible moniker? That would be so embarrassing if they gave themselves that little branding.
I think they gave themselves that moniker.
Oh, that's so bad.
I don't know for sure, but I think they did. And actually, there's a I think it's Wine Spectator. There's a cover to a Wine Spectator that I saw with a photograph of Randall Graham from Bonnie Doon Vineyards dressed as the Lone Ranger.
Oh my God, I'm seeing it now.
Yep.
Oh my God.
Yep.
Oh, this is not a good look, buddy.
That, by the way, is one of the most respected winemakers like in the history of United States viticulture.
Wow. Yeah, the horse is looking at the camera like, yeesh. Ooh.
it was ill-advised. Wow. And
oh, boy.
So regardless of the silliness of the moniker Roan Rangers and all of that, there were people who were trying to change the conversation of California wine from something that favors the big and the powerful and the extracted to something that looks for more subtlety and elegance, while being in no way subtle or elegant themselves. And then you have Stoltman come along just about a decade later as sort of the second wave of the Roan movement in California. And Tom Stoltman plants this vineyard, and it's mostly to Syrah with a little Sangiovese, and there's plenty of Roussanne.
Sangiovese!
And Stoltman has become, for me anyway, a great example of the modern wine zeitgeist being one that has room for ripeness and power, but also elegance, one that wants to talk about social issues as they relate to wine and environmental issues as they relate to wine, while still making a very refined product. The wine being that more modern take on the conversation of the time, I think doesn't work with Delroy, who is incredibly not of the present. And I should say Paul, the character.
But you think it works for Eddie and Melvin and Otis? Like, you think the wine matches to their storylines?
I do, because they took the lessons from their experience and rolled them into the men that they are today. They didn't ignore it. They grew. And Paul didn't grow.
No. Paul shrank. And his guilt and his anger and his PTSD just, like, corroded him from the inside out.
And he basically ruined his son with it.
See, you're talking about how, but all of your things about the stuff that you like about the pairing working in the zeitgeist, this is all intellectual.
Yes.
Like, this is a philosophical connection that you're making between the two that you think works.
Yes.
But does the pairing work synesthetically? Like, does this wine go well with this movie? And I don't think they complement each other at all. I don't think they're bad together. I just think it's nothing. It's a nothing pairing.
Synesthetically, in the moment for me, the most that I can get is like the closest I can get to a good pairing moment is like the filthiest. Like the movie is not clean. They're dirty the whole time. Yeah. They're sweaty. They're like in war. There's blood everywhere.
They're humping. Yeah.
And the wine is, despite having that sort of coppery, irony, blood note to it, is very fruit-driven. Yeah. I would say that opposites pairing. You know, I have experienced plenty of, like, very, very earthy foods served with very, very fruit-driven wines that just works. Like, a mushroom risotto with Perigord truffles is a very earthy dish. And if you pair that with a really young, fruit-driven Pinot Noir, it's beautiful.
Now I'm wondering what's for dinner. I want mushroom risotto.
Truffles are not in season. Just so
I don't
you know.
I don't care about the expensive ones. I just like mushrooms and the flavor of my risotto. So something I was thinking about with the wine, which is like how I think it's at odds with the movie, in the way that the movie is glompy. Things are glomped onto it. The wine, be with me here, it has a singular taste. Like, we can pick out all these different notes and different flavors in it.
Yes.
But it in the way that, like, a great cocktail feels unified. Like, I drink this wine, and it's one. Like, that, for me, is that the elegance of it? Like, it
yes.
is it's and clean and perfectly achieved.
The specific word that I would use for that is linear.
Linear. That's what linear means. It's one successful, unified flavor.
Essentially, yes. When my primary job was creating cocktails, like when I was head bartender at Tishan, one of the ways that I visualized it for myself in my head is like, if I have one ingredient, think of a Venn diagram, right?
Okay.
And one ingredient is a circle. And then ingredient two is another circle, and those don't overlap.
That's not a Venn diagram.
Just wait.
Okay.
Then you have a third ingredient that is its own circle that is between those two that makes a double Venn diagram.
Right.
Then you can draw a line through that Venn diagram, and it works in a linear way on your tongue. That's how I visualized it to myself.
Linearity.
Yes. So what about the linearity of this wine?
Yes.
Well, you asked me to agree with you that it has a singular flavor.
I guess it's linear. It is one clean taste. It's not like I'm getting, you know, like we picked out all the little notes in it, but like I drink it and it is just one, it pristine. It's unified. It feels perfect. It feels like a perfect expression of what it is, and nothing is sticking out.
Right.
Which is the exact opposite of this movie, which is like rough edges all the fuck over the place.
That's true. You know what this wine does pair really well with? Marvin fucking Gaye.
Oh, interesting. You know, I was listening to What's Going On with my son today while we were folding laundry, and he was just like dancing and like rubbing his butt on everything. That's what he does when he dances now. Just like having a great time. This little like ultra privileged white, almost 5-year-old listening to Marvin Gaye's protest album from 50 years ago.
Twerking.
Just grooving, having a great time. Daddy, what's this song about? Oh, shit.
That's
man.
A big conversation, little homie.
God, I love all the Marvin Gaye in it.
It's so good, and I think the music alone works with the wine. And like maybe it doesn't in the way that you're saying about the glompiness with the movie in tow, but that, I mean, Marvin Gaye, it has like silky smooth tones that just like,
it's just a perfect voice every time.
Just beautiful. And I think that that unification that you were talking about, that linearity of the flavor of this wine, I think it's perfect with that album.
That vocals only version of What's Going On.
Dude.
Yeah, so Spike apparently had already committed to using much of the album as the soundtrack for the movie. And then I guess it was his music supervisor or something was like, hey, we found Marvin's isolated vocal track from the song. And like, that is a very produced song. Like, there is a lot of layers and a lot of instrumentation and a lot going on. And now I don't ever want to hear the regular version of What's Going On. I just want to hear
just the vocals,
Marvin's isolated vocals. Cause it's like, oh, you don't need all the rest of this. Because, like, the meaning of the song and the lyrics stand out so much more clearly when you drop everything else. I have an alternate wine pairing for this movie.
Okay, go on with it.
Beer. This is a beer movie. It's not just because they drink beer several times. Like, it's a... You need something bubbly and a little bit frothy. Like, I don't know, I wanted to feel like I drank a little bit too much by the end of it. Like, it's a hangout movie. It's a hanging out, like, with your buds movie, at least for a while.
For a short while?
It's beer. Beer is what I want. What kind of beer would you pair with this movie?
The kind of beer that you would drink in Vietnam, which would be, like, macro lager. You know, like Miller Lite or any of the, like, large production Pilsner style beers.
Yeah, something like super clean and light and easy. And
I think that would be a great pair with this movie.
Summer beer.
Yeah, summer beer. It's perfect. I honestly can't think of a better pair than that for this. If it had to be wine, I think white wine would kind of be better suited to this.
Just any white wine, because it doesn't really matter, right?
I hate you.
Just a white wine. Just something white.
Why are you like this?
Jamie, what do violets smell like?
They smell like violets, motherfucker.
Yeah.
So no, I would go with maybe an orange wine, actually. That glompiness might work with the, like, you're expecting a white wine, but there's tannin.
Wait, is this a thing, an orange wine?
Yeah, orange wine is wine that's made like it's a red wine, except it's white grapes. So it comes out with extra color from the skins, but also tannin and extraction and a fuller body. And, like, they tend to be a little bit disorienting when you drink them, especially if it's not a thing that you drink a bunch. So yeah, and orange wine would I think work really well. Maybe from Friuli, one of the like Grauner or Radicon, something a little bit funky, a little bit volatile, I think would be a good pairing.
Well, I like that. You'll have to send me one of those.
Yeah, we will definitely get around to an orange wine on the show.
Yeah. Because yeah, I loved the movie, obviously, and I loved the wine. But again, like every time I would take a drink of it and I would try and think about it critically, I was like, this is a great wine, and it's not sparking. It wasn't enhancing the experience of watching the movie at all. It wasn't detracting from it, but they were two things that were happening side by side. You know, they stayed in their own lanes, and nothing, even though there are notes like the meatiness or my mouthful of pennies, like blood note or the broadness of it, but those are all entirely abstract connections that we're making. I didn't have that magic that I had last time.
In an unqualified way, I love both the movie and the wine, and I enjoyed myself, but I think that you're right that it doesn't have the synesthesia that we're looking for.
Right.
So, well, for me, I don't know, if we're ranking it, maybe 2.5 out of 5 stars on the, like, good pairing-o-meter.
Yeah, okay. So you're going for stars. I mean, you've already got your toe-thumb branding. We could just go for thumbs, but no, you wanna go for stars. I'm just going to say it is an unsuccessful pairing of two things that are very good.
That's probably a better way to say it.
Yeah, I thought so.
All right. So next time.
Next time. Next time on.
2 weeks from now. We did the same thing. I chose a wine and you paired a movie to it.
That is right. So, Jamie, tell us what the wine is and what you told me about it.
So we're going from classic landmark producer Barmes Boucher in Alsace of France, their entry-level Riesling, which they call Tradition, 2018. The words that I used to describe it were piercing, bright, ripe, and intense.
And from that, and sticking with our theme of 2020 movies that were largely overlooked by the viewing populace, I chose another one of my favorites from last year, which is Thomas Vinterberg's Another Round, which just won Best International Film at the Academy Awards. Vinterberg was also nominated for Best Director, and it stars Mads Mikkelsen as part of a group of friends who are all high school teachers who enter into an experiment to see if they can be drunk all day, basically.
Love it.
And they start microdosing with alcohol, very disciplined, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, to see if it affects their work performance. And, like, spoilers, there's a lot of alcoholism in this movie. It's a comedy, it's a drama, it's fucking heartbreaking. It has an amazing Mads Mikkelsen performance in it. And it has, like, the best ending of anything in 2020. It's super fucking good.
Dope.
Another Round is currently available on The Who of Lou, where you can check it out. The Tradition Riesling is also available from Moore Brothers. Is that correct?
That's correct. Moore Brothers Wine Company. I believe that one was $25.
$25. And Another Round on The Who of Lou and anywhere you get your VOD rentals if you don't have Hulu.
All right. Reviews.
We have a new review from friend of the show, Adrian. Who I'm just going to read the title of her Apple Podcast review because it is the greatest compliment that anyone could possibly leave for a show as far as I'm concerned, which is, "So good, I don't even listen at 1.75 times speed." Thank you for that so much.
It's a good one.
I feel so vindicated. It's really good. All right, Jamie, take it away.
So Adrian says, "I'm terrible at exactly two things, judging movies and judging wine. Scott and Jamie are dragging me kicking and screaming toward being better at both. I love listening to these two professional malarkists, parenthetical malarkers, tease each other while also being smart and passionate about their respective things. I've seen more good movies in the past 2 months than the previous 5 years because of the show, and I'm not even mad about it. Also, hashtag Team Scott forever. Grapefruit is disgusting. Adrian, while I love the sentiment, grapefruit's delicious, and you and Scott are wrong.
Adrian, let's get hashtag Team Scott. So Jamie read it as though it's hashtag Team Scott forever, which I'm way more on board with. But let's get hashtag Team Scott trending. If you're a social media person, let's make it go, and we're gonna take down the grapefruit industrial complex. All right, grapefruit. So if you would like to leave a review of the show, please do. We would really appreciate that. Reviews and ratings on the Apple Podcast platform, which is recently unfucked from a borderline fatal error that had us disappear from their pages for a few days. Thank you, Apple. Really help audiences find new shows like ours, and they help, conversely, new shows like ours find audiences. So leave us a rating, and if you can take the time, write a review there, and we'll read it on the air every time.
We will. We promise, forever and always.
Forever and ever.
Yeah. So, Scotty, do you have things, movies you want people to watch, things to plug?
Man, there's just so much shit out there. I'm going to do a Jamie thing. I'm not going to plug any particular movie. I think people should seek out your local art house independent theater on their website. They are almost certainly offering what are called virtual cinemas. I've mentioned them on this show before. And it's basically just a way to like VOD rent movies, but half of the proceeds go to your independent theater. If you just watched the Oscars, for example, and are one of the people who are outraged that Anthony Hopkins won for The Father, and you're like, he can't possibly be better than Chadwick Boseman. He's really fucking good in that movie, and you can watch The Father and give your $20 to iTunes, or it's available from a lot of independent theaters, and you could give them your $15 or $20 to rent it, and then half of that money would go right to the theater and help them pay their bills and reopen.
Damn right.
So, virtual cinema from independent theaters, whatever your beloved little art house theater that shows all the cool weird stuff is. If their doors are closed or they're open, it seems like we're going to be doing the virtual thing for a while. So check it out and send them a little bit of your money if you can. And you'll watch some dope movies along the way.
Very well said, Scotty.
Indeed. James, what are you drinking other than everything?
So I'm actually not going to do a plug for a thing that I'm drinking. I'm going to plug another podcast.
What?
Yeah, if you've got room in your life for another podcast and happen to be interested in wine and also social issues, head on over to B for Bacchus, an incredible podcast done by a woman named Farah Baru. It's a podcast about wine with an intense focus on Lebanon. We don't really think of wine necessarily when we think of Lebanon, but it has a huge winemaking tradition and does put out some truly world-class wines. Right now, the current episode is about a movie that just came out called Wine and War, which is about the wine industry in Lebanon as it relates to the war-torn history of the country. Go to our website, beforbacchus.com, for just a ton of educational and entertaining content. I think she and her show are great.
Word. That sounds awesome. All right, Jamie, take us home.
So, cats and kittens, thanks for joining us. Make sure that you follow us on all the social media platforms at Bigger Bottle Pod. If you have a question or you just want to lavish us with your attention, go ahead and email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Make sure you remember to rate, review, and subscribe if you like us, or even if you don't, honestly. And remember to drink more wine, watch more movies. It's good for you, we promise.
Yeah. And any of the new people who tuned in after our surprisingly popular Oscar episodes, sorry, that's not what we're doing all the time. And we hope you enjoyed this. Good night, right, Everyone. See you, Jamie.